This is Jason Horsley for The Liminalist, a podcast between, coming to you from horticulture.com. Today I'm speaking to James Howard Kunstler, whose reputation precedes him. I've spoken to Jim twice before, and this time we're going to repeat the formula of our first conversation, which is that one part will be here at The Liminalist and another will be over at Jim's website. Meanwhile, here is me and Jim. Yeah, I was saying to my wife yesterday that because we watched some of your YouTube videos and interviews and stuff, that I said, Kunstler, he's intelligent and cheerful. That's so unusual, that combination.
Well, gosh, thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. I watched some of your recent ones. So one of them was a talk you gave in Europe on architecture and stuff.
Yeah.
And it was very enjoyable. And one thing jumped right out at me, which was something you said about people who invent new cosmologies in order to justify things they want to do. And from there you went on to talk about these starchitects, which I hadn't heard that phrase, and this whole area of creating buildings that cause people anxiety. And that, you know, those two very powerful concepts together were, I mean, they really struck me, because that's actually kind of the thesis of Prisoner of Infinity, which I've been working on for years now, which you read one chapter of about Kurzweil. It's very much about this thing of creating cosmologies in order to justify behaviours, and then even this idea of using stress as a way to alter people's consciousness. So without getting into that, because obviously that's my bag, just to explain why that was so intriguing to me, I wondered if you could give me an example of this, of a cosmology that was created to justify behaviors, and just talk a bit about that, so I've got an idea of where you're coming from with that.
Well, a few years ago, I've been a member of the New Urbanist movement for a long time, for at least 20 years. Mm-hmm. And a few years ago, we've been constantly at war with the Harvard Graduate School of Design, which is the Harvard Architecture School and Urban Planning School. And we've been at war with them for as long as the organization's been around. You know, the whole thing is that they try to paint the New Urbanism movement as being sentimental and silly and solely preoccupied with front porches and picket fences, and none of that is true. But then the question arises, you know, what is the Harvard Graduate School of Design actually interested in? And them being the mandarins of architectural education, it was interesting to examine, you know, where they're at, where they come from. And so they started a kind of parallel movement called landscape urbanism about, I don't know, 7-8 years ago. Mm-hmm. They imported a couple of professors, one guy to run the department named Charlie Waldheim, from, I think he was at either Penn or at a college in Toronto. And these guys were landscape architects who were trying to put across the idea that, you know, there was nothing wrong with the suburban movement, and that they had some ideas for reforming the landscape in a way that they thought made sense. Anyway, we started a big fight with them, a pissing match, and we published a book of essays against them. And it was called Landscape Urbanism and Its Discontents. Hmm. And I wrote a chapter that was titled "The Zombies from Gund Hall Go Forth to Eat America's Brains." Gund Hall being the building that the Harvard Graduate School of Design is in.
Right.
And so the whole idea really is kind of this, is that they're solely concerned at this point in history with being at the cutting edge of architecture. And the trouble with the cutting edge is that it's cutting civilization's throat. The whole idea in many parts of the American graduate school is that now, in order to justify what your project is or what your thesis is or what your dissertation is, you have to create a whole new metaphysic in order to kind of justify the whatever, you know, project you're doing.
Right.
And there really aren't that many credible metaphysics out there that make sense, so that most of the ones that are generated out of the grad schools are foolish in one way or another, or really don't add up, or are obviously being done just for the sake of pretending to create a new way of looking at the world.
Right.
And so all of this has been in the service of the so-called cutting edge.
Is it a tradition, though, this the creation of cosmologies in order to, or how it intersects with architecture? Like, is it related to cathedral building, for example? I mean, obviously, cathedrals are based on a cosmology. So, I mean, miles away from that? Or?
Yeah, it's a million miles away from that in the sense that it's fundamentally dishonest.
Yeah.
You know, these are not cosmologies or metaphysics that are designed to make sense out of the world. They're designed to confuse and confound people. And it's no accident that the architecture that grows out of these fake cosmologies ends up just confusing, confounding people's ideas of how the city ought to function and how the buildings ought to relate to the other buildings and how the human being works within the context of all of that.
Right.
And the result is that you get buildings like Rem Koolhaas's Seattle Main Library building, which is this strange metallic kind of spaceship looking thing in downtown Seattle, full of spaces that are strangely shaped and are designed to provoke anxiety in people.
Right.
Because Koolhaas likes to do that. He thinks that that's, you know, that he's performing a public service by making people feel bad in the environment that they're in.
Yeah, which is pretty weird and interesting in itself. And but is the cosmology, does it relate to this idea of creating anxiety, as in, is that part of the cosmology?
That's sort of what I'm struggling with, the, you know, trying to explain the idea of the cutting edge, is that, you know, within the context of the elite architecture schools and the mandarins who infest it, the cutting edge is really about making people feel bad.
Right.
And that's probably not a good recipe for carrying on the project of civilization.
And is there a basis for that philosophy? Like, do they have a reason why they think people should be made to feel bad?
I think that if you asked Koolhaas, Rem Koolhaas, the Dutch architect, he would probably explain it in terms of saying, you know, he's only expressing the contradictions and anxieties that the culture itself is producing. And insofar as the culture and the economy generates all of this bad feeling, then the monuments and buildings that we construct ought to reflect that.
Right. So it's not meant to be.
I think it's much more complicated than that. You know, Frank Gehry's kind of a different case. Frank Gehry, the Canadian-American architect who designs all these kind of wavy buildings with titanium claddings and very strange torqued surfaces.
Like the melting building?
A lot of his buildings appear to be melting because he became a master of computer-aided design. Otherwise known as CAD. And so he kind of took that to the limit for how much you could tweak and torque surfaces to make the buildings look lively, interesting, you know, so that the surfaces were dancing. The trouble with that is he's built buildings that are visually interesting as sculptures, and I think primarily he really is a sculptor who unfortunately is working in the medium of buildings. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, in order for buildings to really succeed over time, they have to have some capacity for adaptive reuse. And one of the things I think we really can predict is that a lot of the buildings that were built with experimental materials and assembled in experimental ways that were never really done before, for which there's no previous experience or track record, you know, they're going to prove to be buildings that don't have any capacity for adaptive reuse. And they'll have one generation of use, and that'll be it. For example, you know, you take a Geary building with its fanciful, curved, tweaked titanium claddings. Well, for one thing, metals like titanium are very expensive, and you know they're difficult to mine and process and work with. And because we're kind of gliding into the sunset of the techno-industrial age, I don't know why anybody would think that we're going to necessarily have access to those materials or have the ability to work with them in the future. So, you know, when those claddings need to be replaced, you know, what are you going to do? What are you going to do with all the glass curtain walls out there in the boxy glass office buildings? For one thing, they require a huge amount of silicone gaskets and, you know, to just hold the glass in and make a seal. And what makes us think that we're going to be able to even manufacture silicone gasket material in 50 years or 100 years? Right. I mean, you know, there's this kind of, one of the meta cosmologies of our time is that progress is forever on an upward path. And that may not be exactly how things work. You know, it may be more a matter of, you know, one step forward, two steps back, two steps forward, one step back. You know, maybe we go around in some circles and cycles. You know, maybe progress isn't a permanent installation of the human condition. We've been so conditioned by the fantastic experience of the 19th and 20th centuries, and now the beginning of the 21st, that we assume that you know, the human project is going to continue to be the way it was in those two rather anomalous periods of history.
Right.
I don't believe that at all.
Well, that notion of progress, indefinite progress, you traced it back to the Enlightenment and positive rationalism, was it? And that period of cosmology creation.
Yeah, that was a big watershed for the human race of the Enlightenment and developing ideas like it would be a good thing if our beliefs were demonstrable. You know, if we could prove the things that we said we believe by some logical method, which, you know, ended up being the scientific method.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of empiricism, that there's such a thing as things that we can measure and know pretty much demonstrate.
Isn't there? It seems to me there's an element of imposition that creeps into that. If you see what I mean, like if there's this desire to demonstrate what people think they know, they'll figure out a way to actually impose it on reality and you know, realize their own prophecies. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's one of the big pitfalls. And in fact, I had a father-in-law, back when I was married, whose favorite book, he said, was called How to Lie with Statistics. And that's certainly what's going on now. In fact, right now there is a major kind of meme or belief that is pretty well embedded in the intellectual classes of the West anyway. And that idea is that if you can measure stuff, if you can measure just about everything, then you can control it.
Right.
And so we have this, you know, this kind of mania and preoccupation with statistical analysis. And we saw it a lot, of course, in the urban design field, because it got so bad in urban design in the late 20th century that virtually all of the decisions that were important about how the human environment was laid out ended up being made by traffic engineers. Mm-hmm. And you know, the result is visible for everybody to see, which is that we have a really crummy everyday environment to live in. You know, that's really deeply unsatisfying in most parts of North America. But that's the result of the idea that, you know, all you need to do is measure stuff, present statistics, and then goodness follows from that. So I think it indeed has a lot of pitfalls.
Well, one thing about the progress, this notion of eternal, endless progress, occurred to me, it's very obvious, but it just occurred to me yesterday listening to you talk, was that, like, the one most dependable model we have to refer to, which is the human life, our own and other people's, there's no evidence. I mean, all the evidence is to the contrary, that things don't just get better and better, right? They actually, at a certain point, they stop getting better and they start getting worse and worse, and then it's over, right? That's the natural life cycle.
Well, there would seem to be a lot of validity to that. I mean, especially from where I sit at my point in life, where, you know, I'm now entering my later years, and things fall apart. Yeah, it's a constant battle against entropy, and in the end, you're dead. And one does like to think. I like to think. I don't know if this is valid, but I like to think that you can find some joy along the way, and that the joy makes the journey somewhat worthwhile. I'm not completely cynical about the journey itself being pointless and cruel.
Mm-hmm. No, me neither. But and actually, my wife said this when I mentioned how cheerful you were. She said, oh, he's a doomer. Doomers are always cheerful because they've faced facts.
Oh. Wow.
And there's just something, I think, there's something really freeing and uplifting about facing reality. And so I would say that that's pertinent to this point, that if we're in this illusion about endless progress, which entails denying the evidence, everyday evidence of our senses, then we're not ever able to just settle into the reality that things do get worse at a superficial level. We do get old, disease, death. These are realities that, in my opinion, are never going to change and don't need to be changed, mm-hmm. because there's something deeper happening here.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what the question is, though, Jason.
No, it wasn't a question, just... Well, I can make it a question then, because you talked about how important it is for us to find purpose in life, how yeah. central that is to having a good life. And I agree, and I'm, like yourself, a writer, perhaps primarily, and I do get a lot of purpose out of that, a feeling of meaning on a day-to-day basis. But I'm also, being a writer, I'm also a thinker, a deep thinker, and one of the things I think deeply about every day is death and this reality that I'm referring to. And it's not really writing and the purpose I get from day-to-day stuff isn't really a buffer against that awareness.
Mm-hmm.
If you see what I mean. So I'm wondering how it is for you in terms of you have a day-to-day purpose, but you also have an awareness that all of these things you do that seem meaningful are going to be, well, I mean, how do they withstand the context of an awareness of your mortality in terms of giving your life purpose and meaning? Because I know you're not a religious person, so...
No, but to be honest about it, I was much more concerned with the issue of death and dying when I was a young person than I am now. And I'm not really sure why that is, but I can offer some guesses. One is that I produced a body of work that I'm satisfied with, that you know, I don't think so much about... being communicating with the people in the world after I'm gone, I'm not sure that that's so important to me, but just that I got it done. You know, just that I did, you know, I fulfilled whatever my mission was. You know, I actually stepped up to the plate and I did it, and I'm satisfied with that. You know, another feature of my life was that I went through a series of sort of health crises in my early 60s. And it went on for a long time, and, you know, I had a chronic illness from, I got cobalt poisoning from a bad hip replacement implant. And I had this mystifying illness that the physicians didn't understand. And it took me a long time to get it diagnosed. And in the meantime, you know, I was feeling worse and worse, and I had a series of surgeries, and I had to have a bad implant removed and replaced, and I got another one, and had a spine surgery, and in the course of the first attempt to do the spine surgery, my EKG misbehaved, and they discovered I had a blocked artery in my heart. So I had a single bypass, but, you know, it was a big operation. They cracked my chest open and, you know, did the whole thing. And with all that and those, you know, first of all, the experience of coming out of open heart surgery is a little bit like returning from the dead. And I can't really account for it in any, you know, empirical way, but I did feel differently about death when I got out of that. I do remember very vividly coming directly out of anesthesia and having a tube down my throat and being incredibly uncomfortable from that, but I was slipping in and out of the anesthesia during that liminal period of maybe an hour or so. And I found it such a blessed relief to be going unconscious, and so I found it so awful to be returning to the reality of, you know, being on a gurney with a tube down my throat and all kinds of hoses coming out of me. So I got a sort of a taste of the, you know, the blessed relief of what it's like to leave the, you know, leave your consciousness. And except for me, it wasn't permanent. So, you know, here I am back again battling with the world and trying to stave off more illness and trying to carry on every day.
Thank you.
quite a few testimonies like that. I think people who've had near-death experiences, the feeling of relief of going, and then the feeling of the opposite of relief of having to come back. So,
yeah. I have to say, sorry for interrupting, but yeah. I have to say that, you know, that just might be a cognitive feature of what anesthesia does to you. So it may not be a cosmic thing so much as just, you know, how your brain handles that experience.
Yeah, and even if it's not external chemicals, of course, the body releases its own. I mean, my brother had a near-death experience when he was crucified in the Philippines, which he did as an art project anyway. Before and after, he was a card-carrying nihilist atheist who rejected any concepts about life after death. But even he came away from that experience saying, he denied it later, actually, but I was there. I know he said it. He said, if that's death, then there's nothing to be afraid of. But it's interesting, I mean, about how the body takes care of things in terms of, I mean, the body knows what to do. Including dying. The body knows how to die, right? And we could be cynical and say, well, it releases chemicals to just so that, whatever, we could reduce it to a mechanistic thing, but we don't have to. We can just leave it with this sense that the body does know what it's doing, and that includes death, and that, I mean, I want to make this a question because I know you prefer questions. Like, as a writer, somebody who does live in the head a lot, but you also seem to have your feet on the ground. So do you have a sense that the body is a larger portion of what we are and how we actually experience life is physical than it is mental?
Well, it kind of reminds me of what Yogi Berra said when he was talking about baseball. And he said, half of this game is 90% mental. So I really don't know. I dwell in both realms simultaneously, and I have more of a sense of dwelling in my head than in my body. I mean, I sit at a desk and get very involved in the stuff that's going on in my head. And because of, you know, being in what they might call the flow state.
Yeah.
I lose track of, you know, the fact that this chair is not that comfortable and my ass hurts and I've been in the same position for the last 45 minutes and you know, I have to take a leak and et cetera. And then I'm, you know, pushed back into the corporeal realm. So I really... It's very hard for me to state whether I am one thing or the other, or how they are integrated, except to say that they are integrated in a, if you're lucky, I suppose, and you know, you can function serviceably. I mean, for me, a great deal about everyday life really comes down to the practical everyday exigencies of getting done what you have to get done, you know, taking care of your business and doing it in a manner that allows you to feel okay about who you are and what you're doing and where you are.
Right. Yeah, I mean, everybody's ideal, I guess, is to have a peaceful death insofar as they think about it at all. And it seems as though, I mean, this is all mental, but I'll say it anyway, because I think death is something we can't really mentally prepare for myself. But anyway, that a big part of it would be, being at peace would be feeling, as you were saying earlier, that we've done what we needed to do.
Yeah.
So we can let go. Right? Yeah. We're not clinging to unfinished business kind of thing. That's actually the cliche, but I think a lot of cliches are cliches because they're true. And it seems as though you have that sense. I also do. I have to say, I said recently that I don't have a bucket list. I have feel like I've done everything that I need to do before I die, which doesn't mean that I am ready to die or that I don't want to do more things, but just that kind of nagging sense
Sure.
of things undone. I mean, I have it in a general sense because it keeps me doing stuff, but I don't have specifics like, oh, I wish I need to do that or I need to do that. But I would say that many people don't have that, and I just want to bring this out, sort of telescope it outward to the whole culture, and bring it back to this idea that we've got this collective dream of endless progress. As you said, we want to keep on driving to the Walmart, for the for every generation to come, or the equivalent, the Walmart on Mars, basically. Is the dream that so many people are being sold and actually buying into, as opposed to the reality, which is, I would say, that societies can only reflect human life cycles. So societies would also peak and then deteriorate. Entropy sets in with societies also, and that doesn't have to be a bad thing any more than it's a bad thing that we grow old and die, except to the mind that is trying to cling on to these dreams and these illusions. So we're at a stage in society where it seems as though we are nearing the end, or at least the end is in sight. But I would say, as a society, we don't have this, I don't want to call it a luxury because it's so much more than a luxury. We don't have this, the possible peace and the acceptance of saying, well, we've done a good job while we were here, because the society we've created is such a god-awful mess.
Well, one of the things that we're seeing, I think, is that, as we approach what may be a terminal point, not in human history necessarily, or civilization per se, but a terminal point in this particular cycle that I like to call the techno-industrial age. One of the things we're seeing is that as it approaches its end, the complexities of it multiply to such an extent and to such a degree that it becomes extremely punishing psychologically to live amidst all of that hyper complexity. And so I do think that it is the hyper complexity itself that is destroying our capacity to even think about where we are, what we're doing, and what's happening to us. Also, of course, I have to add my own particular notion that while this might be the end of this period of history, I don't at all think it's the end for human activity or human culture or even civilization. But I think that we're heading into what I would call a pretty profound time out from what we've been used to. And it's difficult, if not impossible, to say how long that will last and whether it, whether we'll return to anything like what we've known recently in human experience, because it's been a pretty extraordinary journey from, the world of 1800 to where we are now, with all of its incredibly complex mediated weirdness.
I mean, you've mentioned with world made by hand novels how you've imagined this post-collapse world, and you've imagined it as a place that would actually be quite a nourishing environment and a satisfying environment to live in compared to the one we live in now. And you said that you I forget the word you used, but you were parsimonious with the describing the collapse itself. Partly because the characters wouldn't know, because of the collapse, they wouldn't have
Yeah,
had
just the
access.
logistics of the story would have put them in a position where it would have been hard for them to know, because they, the isolation of different parts of the United States from other parts was a feature of that new world they were living in.
Which makes perfect sense. But as a writer, did you, nonetheless, did you find yourself imagining the scenario? To what extent have you imagined? Because it's of interest to me. Well, I would say obviously it's of interest to me because I think I might just live long enough to see some of this collapse and what it's going to be like. And I know that it's not going to be a nourishing environment to live in, like while it's actually happening. So to what extent have you imagined that, what
Well,
it would look like?
kind of flesh it out a bit in the third and fourth installments of those books. There were four of those books in all, and so in the third and fourth one, I found a device for informing the reader what was going on. I had an interesting sensation or sense of things yesterday while watching Trump's first news conference in many, many months. We're speaking now about a week before he gets inaugurated. And so he had this news conference yesterday. And in my blogs for about the last 6 months, I've been saying and predicting that if Trump did get elected, that he'd be removed by a coup d'etat inside of 60 days. And oddly, that press conference I saw yesterday reinforced that idea. I did not vote for him, and I did not vote for Hillary either. I wrote somebody in the write-in ballot, as we call it down here in the USA. And so I'm not a partisan of Trump, and I'm not a Hillary complainer. But he behaved so strangely yesterday. His behavior is so infantile and peevish and almost insane that I can just imagine a whole lot of people sitting around the halls of government and the Pentagon and, generals with a lot of gold scrambled eggs on their shoulders and, these guys watching Donald Trump in action and just looking at each other and shaking their heads and getting ideas about maybe we can't leave this guy in office. He's too crazy. He's too dangerous. He's too petulant and nutty. And so,
Loose cannon,
the reason I say that is because in the World Made by Hand story that runs through all four books, you get a little bit of narrative about the change in government and how the government fell and how, one president was replaced by a general and then the general was replaced by somebody else and then the government moved from various places and ended up on a actually in a small town on Lake Huron in Michigan. And how the federal government the federal the states had broken up into different regions and stuff. And I laid that out pretty much, but Trump seems to, it reminds me of that old Oscar Wilde epigram that life imitates art, because I'm getting the feeling that Trump is now playing out the narrative that I wrote in World Made by Hand. And I mean, I'm not trying to blow my horn about that. To me, it's just interestingly creepy.
No, I was laughing because that is it's a syndrome that other writers have found themselves caught up in. Philip K. Dick's the most notable example, where he discovered that things he were writing were actually coming true, and it was very specific in his case. It wasn't social prophecy, it was actually in his personal life, things, the people he wrote about, he would then meet them and so on. But it's definitely a larger dynamic that's been explored in terms of writers who have found that their creative imagination seemed to be tapping into something, some kind of faculty of prophecy or whatever.
I had two very strange coincidences involving that, just that. The town that I based the little village in World Made by Hand, an upstate New York old factory village, is like the one I moved to in 2011, and it's about 15 miles outside of Saratoga Springs, where I lived for many, many, many years. And so this little town I'm in, I moved to it in 2011, and I was walking around town one of the first days I was there just to sort of take a good close look at where I was. Mm-hmm. And there was a plaque in a little, it's not exactly a park, but it's kind of a scrap of land on a misshapen block that the village uses as a, just a green space, shall we say. And there was a little monument there to the founder of the town, whose name was Job Whipple.
Mm-hmm.
And it struck me very odd that, you know, that one of the main characters in my book was named Brother Job.
Yeah.
And so that struck me a little. And then I learned pretty much the same day that the town, before it was named Greenwich, which it is now, they don't call it Greenwich, they call it Greenwich.
Mm.
And the high school football team is the Witches. Before it was Greenwich, it was a town known as Union. And they changed the name of it in the 1870s because it was thought that that they didn't want to ruffle the feathers of the late Confederacy, you know, now that the Civil War was over, so they changed the name of the town.
Right.
And the name of the fictional name of the town that I was writing, and I had been writing for several years before I moved out there, was called Union Grove. So I thought that was a kind of a strange synchronicity thing, but I mean, it wasn't cosmic, but it was interesting.
You can mess with my life in a poor one, have me divorced by the time of the chorus. There's no need to change any sentence when you always decide where I go next. Many nights you would hide from the audience, and they were not in tune with your progress. In the end, you're a fool like the journalist who turns what you sing into business. Like a hero, a dark shade of damage distortion, wearing death like a cape or a costume. Cut your ties and leave town when you want to, killing time till I pass to the chamber of the room where you keep my replacement. So fed up, still you're starving on paper. You know him, but he's you only bitter. Damage. I could use the ledge to jump off of. I wasn't lying when I said this was over. I have questions that lead to more questions. Run a tide that will cut off my fingers. You wrote about me on every new record, and I'll show up in a title of your song. I only hope somebody requests it. For you in Washington, I've only seen photos of Washington. I'll never know. Leave me Manhattan, I want the evergreens. Write me a song I can sing in my sleep. As sure as the rain I will fall where you stand, I want you in the skyline, these are my demands. What's it like for you in Washington? I've only seen photos of Washington. I'll never know. No.
I mean, you've read some Jung, I suppose, in your time, have you?
Pardon me?
Have you read any Jung in your time, Carl Jung?
A little bit, but not in a long time.
Because you used the term synchronicity, but another one would be collective unconscious. And,
yeah.
And, I mean, this, yeah. Insofar as there's a reality to that, it's. I don't know if it's not so mysterious, but it doesn't have to be mystical anyway, just that we are all part of a collective perceptual experience, and we can tune into things that are going on outside of our own individual lives. I don't find that particularly mystical myself, or maybe you do, I don't know.
Well, I do find the writing process to be quite mystical for me. I don't go into trance or anything, but for one thing, when I do write, the stories all come out from beginning to end. You know, I don't write the middle and then go to the end and then write the beginning. My stuff really unfolds kind of organically, like an emergent organism. Wow. And I'm a little baffled as to how I'm able to do that, because I know an awful lot of writers who write their books inside out and upside down, and you know, they write the end first and then write the beginning and then finally write the middle. And I can't do that, but these things seem to me to be delivered from the ether. And I don't go into a trance state, but I do go into a flow state.
Mm.
And there is something about flow that suggests, to some perhaps small degree, the idea of a river of greater consciousness out there that you're plugging into, because sometimes it's very hard to explain where these things come from. I think it would be even harder maybe for a musician, or, you know, well, for musicians especially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, back to the body again. Like, the body knows how to do all kinds of things that we can't mentally cognate.
Yeah.
That's the word. So why not imagine? Yeah.
I'm still a little bit amazed at my reflexes, old as I am. You know, I'm very good at, like, you know, when I bobble something, I'm very good at catching them. And I'm always impressed that I have no idea how I did that.
Yeah.
You know?
So bring it back to the long emergency or the slow collapse. And you're talking about Trump and the climate that the U.S. is in now. I'd say the whole world, but it seems to be, it's like the U.S. is the canary in the coal mine in many ways, I think. I mean, one of the ways I imagine the collapse is, do you know the French philosopher René Girard?
No, I do not.
Well, he came up with a very interesting social model, which has to do with mimesis and the scapegoat mechanism. I won't try and break down René Girard, but mimetic violence is the reason I brought him up, which is that when a community or a society is in a period of destabilization, particularly liminality, people are less and less able to turn to the institutions or the norms and the values to know how to behave, and so a kind of free-floating anxiety sets in, and that leads to violence, and, well, it increases mimesis, because people don't know how to behave, so they look to other people to imitate,
mm-hmm.
to figure out how to behave, but because of the tension and the anxiety, there's also increasing hostility, because you're not really sure who you can trust. And so there's a kind of preemptive violence that starts breaking out, as in you'll do to your neighbor what you think they're going to do to you before they do it, kind of thing. And so that this is this social contagion, mimetic violence, and it can, as Girard writes about it, it can be like a forest fire, like in Rwanda.
Yeah.
You know, it once it just gets going, it's very, very difficult to contain it. And,
yeah.
You know, my impressions in the U.S. is it's particularly coming with the Trump thing, the amount of hysteria around this, ideological frenzy, really, that it's not difficult for me to foresee a time when mimetic violence would break out in the U.S. And so there's that on the one hand, and then the notion of balkanization, which of course that's the world that you end up writing about. It's completely fragmented.
Yeah. Well, I think we're already seeing that, Jason. Yeah. I mean, I think that's exactly what's going on with the stupendous murder rate among American blacks in Chicago.
Yeah.
And one of the interesting features of it is, this is going to be very un-PC for me to say, mm-hmm. but, you get a sense from watching the cavalcade of perps, and the cavalcade of young black men who get into trouble, that, they're all the same. Or at least they're all imitating exactly the same model of behavior and mannerism.
Right.
And so I think that that's exactly what we're seeing. And, that happens to be a rather low order of culture in the U.S. These are people who have, are having very rough lives, being brought up not very well, not learning a whole lot about, how to become an adult or develop into an adult, and getting a lot of their signals from other people around them who are similarly poorly developed.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's exactly what you're seeing. It remains to be seen how it's going to spread through the system, and I think that the capacity for it to spread is huge. I notice when I go to the gym, there are all these young guys. I live in this small town in upstate New York in a flyover part of the country where the economy has really suffered. All the factories have closed, and God knows what people are doing to make a buck. A lot of them probably aren't making a buck. And, that's why they're in the gym at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. But you can see that they're developing a kind of a comic book idea of what it means to be a warrior.
Right.
They have these very complex Celtic tattoos on their arms. And they seem to be prepping for some kind of a warrior role. And they're rather pugnacious, in their casual interactions with the other civilians in there, like me. They don't mind kind of, shoving you out of the aisle as you're walking to the other machine, or, it's a kind of a pugnacious and belligerent culture.
Mm-hmm.
And I can see those guys going apeshit pretty easily.
Mm-hmm.
If the delivery to the supermarkets don't get made for a week, or if the ATM machine shut down, or if they can't get this or that, I could see a lot of mischief brewing there. It's just that, our culture in small town America is very damaged, but it's not as damaged as maybe the ghetto in the south side of Chicago or Philadelphia.
Sure. Yeah. Well, there's a primal. The more violence has different expressions, of course.
Yeah.
So the most primal kind of violence is just physical violence, but then there are these much more sophisticated, or if that's even the word, subtle forms of violence. So on the one hand, you're talking about kind of real warrior wannabes. They're not real warriors, but they've got this desire to reconnect to the primal and somehow re-experience that side of themselves.
Well, to be meaningful and potent. One of the conditions of American cultural life right now is the shocking impotence of men in general. And I don't mean sexual impotence.
Yeah.
I mean impotence of action. Of being able to control their own lives and lead meaningful lives and do anything purposeful, and that can make people crazy and violent, and I think that's what we're seeing with that. But there are other kinds of violence that I would identify. For example, the corporate violence that comes in the form of the pervasive racketeering that now infests our economy, where everything is a racket, everything is there's almost no honest business being done. Everything is an effort to extract the maximum from not the customer, but now the victim. You know, whether it's, you know, the hospital patient or, you know, the person in a, you know, in an auto showroom or something, or somebody in a realtor's office. You know, everything's become a racket. And by racket, I mean the dishonest pursuit of money at all costs, so that we end up in a culture which I define as being a culture of anything goes and nothing matters. Mm-hmm. And it's not easy to construct an ethical and moral framework for living within that climate of pervasive racketeering.
It's interesting because that climate of nothing matters seems to have given rise to a sort of compensatory climate in which things that really don't matter are blown out, you know, magnified into these massive issues.
Absolutely. I mean, we're seeing that with the snowflake phenomenon on campus and the massive amount of energy and effort that's being put into the support and validation of gender groups that are so minusculely represented in the population.
Yeah.
That, you know, there are so few of them that it hardly matters. But, you know, they become like the predominant concern of a whole generation of college students.
Yeah, and it also it seems to be an engine of oppression that itself is a kind of violence in terms of what you're allowed to say or even think, and the reaction that one can receive simply for even asking questions.
Yeah, well, there are a couple of things about that I don't think have been discussed enough or made clear, or maybe not even understood. What we're seeing in a lot of the campuses with the despotic behavior of people who are acting like the Red Guard in the Cultural Revolution of Mao Zedong in 1966. What we're seeing is young people enjoying coercion tremendously.
Yeah. Right.
It's not about really the issue so much anymore. It's about exercising your ability to coerce other people, including especially people older than you and people who are more settled into their lives and careers.
Right.
And, you know, it's become the replacement for the old beer blasts and ultimate frisbee games. You know, now the main game on campus is to enjoy the pleasure of coercing, the other people in your world and then collecting brownie points on social media for doing it.
Mm.
That's the game. And, I don't think it's been properly identified. And of course, it's being promulgated by a very strange, shadowy group of professors in the humanities and their allies in the diversity deanship offices. And we know, for example, that with the diversity deans, you know, their motives are a little bit clearer. Their motives are to demonstrate that their services are needed, that there's some problem with diversity that we need them to be there for, to take care of. So they create all these imaginary diversity problems. And then they, you know, the deanships multiply, especially at the better heeled institutions like the Ivy League colleges where they have multiple diversity deans. And, but the students themselves, you know, at this point they're in it for the sheer pleasure of pushing other people around.
Mm.
I don't think it's more complicated than that. And I certainly don't think it has much to do with the actual issues.
No, but I think the complexity comes in, maybe it's not complexity, but depth in terms of why people have found this new game and why they find it pleasurable. And of course, it's the oldest game of all, really, is how you can control others.
Yeah.
How you can put yourself in a position of power over others. That goes right back to infancy when you can't, you know. When you're completely powerless and dependent and all of the trauma of that. So it seems as though that there's a revenge drive behind this game. That's my sense, and that's how it could escalate into actual violence, I think, very easily.
Well, one of the problems of this is that any kind of a really workable moral and ethical framework for daily life would have to consider coercion as being a major sin, a major no-no, a major thing that is not decent and right to do.
Yeah.
And I think what this demonstrates, you know, having elevated coercion into a kind of a sport, what it shows is the incredible decadence of America's own moral, ethical armature.
Mm. Well, it's, I mean, moral outrage is a very gratifying emotional experience, isn't it?
Yeah. I think we can say that that's true.
Right. So what you're saying about the game works because it doesn't feel like a game. So these people, they actually convince themselves. I shouldn't say these people because we all have a tendency to do it. We can convince ourselves that the issue that we're using to ego inflate and get morally outraged and superior about is real, and that that's what's driving our actions to coerce others. We're doing it out of compassion, you know, mm-hmm. for the good, for the general good. I mean, I do think people actually convince themselves of that, and that's precisely what makes it so dangerous. If it was a conscious game, you could just call time out at any time.
Well, I don't think that they're convincing themselves. I think the key to it is that they're convincing each other, and that's where social media comes in. Social media is a big engine for providing that kind of reinforcement for bad behavior.
Right. Yeah, it's a bit like LARPing then, live action role playing.
Yeah. So, you know, so, I mean, I saw it about a year ago. I was still doing college lectures, and I've stopped doing college lectures because you can't get on campus anymore, and nobody wants to hear ideas that make people uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, that's another feature of what's going on is that, you probably noticed that the social justice warrior phenomenon is almost completely devoid of humor.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a reason for that. And the reason is that humor and comedy are based on things that make us uncomfortable.
Yeah, taboos, right.
If you're not willing to tolerate the very idea of discomfort, you know, there's not going to be no such thing as comedy. And that's why the coercion that's going on is just so stark and absolutely without irony or even a self-consciousness of the idiocy of it.
Hmm. Yeah, well, it depends on inflexibility, doesn't it? It's like a compensatory thing for the... the complexification of culture means it's, as you were describing it before, it gets... Well, you described it as punishing, actually, so... But, I mean, before it's punishing, it's destabilizing, it's anxiety, producing this uncertainty. The uncertainty principle grows. The more complex the system is, the harder it is to predict or understand or control. And so then it seems there's a doubling down compensatory reaction to that, which increases the amount of inflexibility and the amount of conviction and zeal and closes down any questioning. So you have a phenomenon, whatever it is, the gender thing is the biggest thing. That actually, I mean, it's incredible how quickly we've gone from Jordan Peterson used the example of a classroom, a college classroom, where somebody stands up and they say, it's a white man, let's say, I think it was, stands up and says, I am a 5-year-old black girl. That is what I wish to be identified from.
Yeah.
Please discuss. And no one in the class will question it. They will all claim to accept that. If you identify as a 5-year-old black girl, then we accept that. That is now a fact.
Yeah,
right?
How
did we get there in 10 years or something? How on earth did we get to that point where we're not able to question something that is completely incomprehensible, really, to us?
Well, I think it's just an extension of the your basic multicultural programming, and that starts, in my opinion, as a reaction to the disappointment of the civil rights campaign. You know, that starting in about the, you know, the 80s and 90s, you start to see this disappointment with how things have worked out.
Mm.
And the failure, really the failure of a common culture, and especially the failure of the common culture to attract people who were invited to become a part of it and then declined. And so then this idea is put in place that, oh, well, you don't need a common culture. You can just have a society with all kinds of competing cultures, and that's okay.
And yeah, like each individual becomes a culture unto themselves.
Well, that's the ultimate destination of what you're talking about, where, you know, a 22-year-old, 6'3" white man gets up and says, well, I really feel like a 5-year-old black girl. And everybody has to go along with the pretense, even though they know it's fake. And that's one of the reasons, of course, that the culture produces so much anxiety, is because there's so much self-evident dishonesty built into the actual actions that it promulgates. So you have you have a set of ideas that are you know, compensatory, and they produce preposterous behavior that nobody really believes. But there are enormous sanctions and punishments for actually stating that they're dishonest.
Yeah.
And I think that Jonathan Haidt, and that's spelled H-A-I-D-T, Jonathan Haidt, is a professor of moral philosophy at NYU. There's a wonderful YouTube of him giving a lecture at Duke University. If you Google Jonathan H-A-I-D-T plus Duke University, you'll see this lecture about how he describes the social justice warrior phenomenon as being essentially a religious movement. And, you know, the religions all have their sacred, precious, sacred objects, and this religion does too. And so, you know, you have to go along with whatever doctrine has been appended to the sacred objects. You know, the main doctrine being that the sacred objects represented victims.
And decrees, yeah.
Yeah, and if you don't go along with that narrative completely,
yeah,
or if you demur from it in any way, you know,
or question it, even.
You're going to be punished. I began saying a few minutes ago, I got off track, but back when I was doing college lectures, I was in one particular lecture, and this Hispanic woman got up as if on cue, and literally said, "I'm offended." Blah, 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 about something that I had said, you know, some point I was making.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I realized that what is actually literally going on campus is a competition for brownie points for offendedness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the person who can rack up the most offendedness brownie points wins.
That's the power of the victim.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, that, of course, you know, entitles you to then turn around and coerce other people.
Yeah, yeah. It's the tail wagging the dog, literally.
But, you know, it's such a grotesque phenomenon. It's every bit as grotesque as the Cultural Revolution was under Mao Zedong. It hasn't had quite the pernicious effect that did on China. Yeah. But it's pretty bad.
Second part of my conversation with Jim Kuntzler, where Jim interviews me, can be heard over at kuntzler.com as of tomorrow. I will post the link in the show notes as soon as it's up. This is Jason Horsley and the Limoist, coming to you from horticulture.com.